everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. I want to bring on my guest for today, Chris Otter, the author of the new book, Diet for a Large Planet, Industrial Britain, Food Systems, and World Ecology. Chris Otter is Associate Professor of History at The Ohio State University. He is the author of The Victorian Eye, A Political History of Light and Vision in Britain, 1800 to 1910. And this is the newest book by Chris Otter, Diet for a Large Planet. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
I just finished reading the book, and I want to say that since it's about food, I might use food terms in describing how to read this book. I suggest digesting in small quantities, small bites at a time. Every sentence is a book in itself. This is very information dense, nutrient dense when we talk about food. And you really need to masticate everything that's in here slowly and carefully. And I can't say that I did that entirely because I didn't allocate enough time because I had no idea how dense it was. But wow, what a volume of work. So I'm just going to give you a little applause here, which you can't hear, but you can see my hands clapping. Let's get started. Basically, you say that Britain laid the foundation for today's global food system. And there's a lot of problems associated with that that we see today: chronic disease, climate change, lots of exploitation around the world, which results in famine and poverty and all kinds of problems. And we frequently point the finger at the United States for most of these problems. And this book goes into the history and says, it all started with Great Britain. So we don't have to take all of the blame here in the United States. I also liked how you obviously mentioned Francis Moore LePay's groundbreaking book, Diet for a Small Planet, and took your title from her title. I'm really looking forward to her 50th anniversary edition, which comes out next year.
Right.
Kind of anxious to see what she has to say about that. That book had a big impression on me. I don't think I read it until the late 70s when I was in college, but it came out in 71. And what's amazing about that is here it is 50 years later, and what have we learned from her book? I don't know that we've learned much or that changes have been made from all of the things that she brought out. Okay. But it's important to go back in history and find out how we got to where we are today. You cited an expression, slow violence, early in the book.
Right.
That really hit me profoundly because it's really taken a long time to see the impact of Great Britain's actions and other countries' actions as well. Slow violence. I'm going to be bringing up a number of things, and I have to say that in some ways, it was reading it as quickly as it did. There are so many quotes and so many references that I wasn't keeping track of what you were saying originally or what you were bringing up that someone else said. So let's jump into some of the chapters. You have a handful of chapters. I'll just read them. There's meat, wheat, sugar, risk, violence, metabolism, bodies, earth, and acceleration. Meat was a very difficult chapter to read. I'm a vegan, and reading about what humans do to animals over our history is a very difficult thing. And you present it all very objectively, very factually. This is what happened here, this is what happened here, blah, da, da, da. How did you feel writing that chapter?
It's a deeply unpleasant history, the history of livestock farming, livestock breeding, the history of large-scale animal slaughter. And obviously, in a more academic book like this, this is the way these books are written. And I think that to a certain extent, writing, as I say, objectively, is obviously critical. I'm writing in a critical vein, but I'm not necessarily writing with vast amounts of emotional language. I'll leave that to my reader. And you know, that's there for you to take away from this. I mean, the major, you mentioned slow violence here. This is quick violence, but there's also a slow violence to the way that livestock have been bred and the way that livestock's very form and existence has transformed fairly dramatically over the past 150 years or so. So yeah, it's hard work writing about things, but historians write about unpleasant things all the time. History,
and there's unfortunately a lot of unpleasant things to write about.
Right. History isn't nice and shouldn't be sanitized. And the history of foods is a history that contains a lot of unpleasant things.
History shouldn't be sanitized, and yet I know that when I was going through school in my early years learning about history, I think there was a lot of sanitizing going on. We read about wars, but we didn't learn about the real impact on the victims. It was just, right, this war happened in this date, and this general ran here and won, and hooray, and here we are.
Right, right, right. I mean, I think that there are moves afoot to make. I apologize for my dog in the background.
Perfectly fine. I have a lot of dog-loving listeners.
No, I think that history in school, in middle school, and in high school can clearly still be taught in a sanitized way. But I think there are moves afoot to change that, particularly in the way that the history of things like slavery and race relations in the United States is taught. We don't teach the history of livestock farming and food production in school. That's something that's left to college level courses, and college level courses wouldn't sanitize this.
Correct.
You can't write. I mean, the history of meat is not something that can be, is an emotive and complicated subject, and is not something that can be done without looking at the history of killing and at the history of livestock conditions too.
I've taken little bits out from your book. Some of them I may quote. In the meat chapter, you write, "Livestock populations rose precipitously in number while individual animals had their shapes manipulated, their flesh restructured, their biology altered, and their lifespans telescoped." Okay, let's go to wheat. Wheat is a fascinating subject. I've read books that specifically focus on the history of wheat, the history of bread. We have a lot of romantic notions about bread. And what's interesting is how our cultural notions of bread have changed, where when white bread first came out, it was for the rich and it was somewhat of a luxury item. And then it became so cheap, and now it's unfortunately a low nutrient food for the poor. And we're coming back to appreciating whole grains and heavier breads. It's just a funny thing how our perspective changes.
Right.
And your book is full of references of experts or political people or nutritionists or doctors, just a wide variety of people who make statements about things, as we see today, may not be founded on any truth or science.
Right.
Just notions of the day.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't mind me sort of jumping in here, I mean, the history of nutritional science is itself relatively recent. It really only develops in the later 19th century when we have concepts like the calorie and protein and fat and carbohydrate. These only kind of solidify around then, and chemical analysis develops. And therefore, there are kind of competing scientific ideas about what bread should be and how it should work. But it's very, very hard to detach those from so simple cultural idea of bread. So the idea of what is an ideal bread loaf has undergone many transitions and transformations, and there's still a kind of clash over this today. I mean, do you want to be spending $6 for on a Whole Foods extremely grainy bread? Or do you want to spend a dollar for some sort of Wonder Bread equivalent? The argument over which of these is more nutritious, I think, as I try and say in the book, is actually in many ways just a cultural argument. You know, I think we overblow how bad for us sliced white bread is, given the other things that we eat alongside it. And so it's really very much, bread has always been a cultural marker. throughout its entire, the entire history of bread is a history of cultural differentiation. So
an image that you give in the chapter for wheat, I want to read it because I just loved it. The decline of domestic baking produced the, quote, contemptible, unquote, phenomenon of a, quote, crowd of men and women living together in a house and constantly looking out of it for people to bring them food and drink, unquote. And this is so true. And then I'm thinking of today with coronavirus, and it's even more true than ever, where we are so dependent on the food system that when we're locked down, we're looking out, who's going to feed us? Who's going to bring us our food? It's an interesting situation we've gotten ourselves into.
Right. And of course, many people, myself included, have been baking more during COVID. So this is something that's sort of very much coming home to us. I mean, the quote you mentioned there, I think is from William Cobbett, writing in the early 19th century. And for him, the demise of domestic baking was not just a sign of the kind of collapse of independence, but it was also all about the rise of capitalism. For him, the idea that we were now reliant upon others to bake for us was indicative of the way in which these things have become sort of marketized and commoditized, which, you know, wheat, as I argue here, is one of the central commodities in the rise of global capitalism in the last couple of hundred years. There's sort of giant markets in this, which ultimately are connected to this collapse of a kind of local economy, where people across the British Isles would make breads made with many grains, or would use grains to make things which weren't breads, sort of porridges and flatbreads, all of these other forms of grain products. In a sense, they go into quite serious decline. The history of oatmeal is important here, or porridge as it's called in Scotland. The national dish of Scotland was oatmeal, which is more healthy than wheat bread. And the demise of oatmeal is linked to a decline in the nutritional qualities of the Scottish diet. And then we might also think about the revival of oatmeal in the latter part of the 20th century, in an age of concern about cholesterol and so forth, when the sort of nutritional qualities of oatmeal are kind of reappreciated. So the history of bread and of grains and our consumption of them is really nonlinear. It transforms along with cultural changes, social changes, scientific changes, changes in our bodily health. Yeah, maybe the age of homogenous wheat bread might be coming to an end.
Well, it is in places where we have the means.
Yeah.
To choose what we're consuming.
Yeah.
I know in this house, I try and diversify as much as we can with all kinds of grains and whole grains. I even grind my own flours here.
Uh-huh.
I really try and keep it as close to natural, whatever natural means.
Right.
We consume oats and millet and quinoa and buckwheat. Also, I'll make flours from beans like lentils and garbanzo. And it really makes for a nice range of interesting foods to consume.
Yeah.
Wheat has a profound history, and it's connected to culture and classes and poverty and capitalism, which you mentioned. And I'm wondering, this chicken and the egg thing, is which came first? All of this is market driven. Are we here today with our food system the way it is because of capitalism?
To a certain extent, yes. It's impossible to disaggregate the history of the food we eat and the systems which produce it from capitalism. As I argue in the book, and also from particular forms of capitalism. The argument in the book, just very kind of simply for those out there listening, is that as Britain industrialized, it was a really quite conscious decision to outsource food production from many parts of the world. This is why I call it a large importing food from Argentina, Australia, North America and so forth, and and many other parts of the world. And this was explicitly about industrial capitalism. And explicitly the argument here was that ultimately it was cheaper to allow food to be grown overseas, particularly wheat. Wheat is the most important thing here, because by about 1900, something like 80% of wheat consumed in Britain came from overseas. And this was simply because it was cheaper to do it. It was cheaper in terms of wages. It was cheaper in terms, even transport costs had fallen so dramatically.
It was cheaper in the short term.
Right. It's cheap if you ignore what economists call externalities. If you ignore the environmental costs in terms of food miles and in terms of degraded soils and in terms of climate change, and if you ignore the awful conditions that many people produced this food in. But the idea here is that when you're on these kinds of frontiers, these global frontiers, those kinds of issues can be ignored by capitalists. You can pay people very little money. You don't have any concern about environmental regulation. This was the cheapest way to produce food. And so the argument therefore was that you have an industrialized core and an agrarian periphery. And this brings the whole planet into play. And this is exactly what Francis Moore Lepage get away from with Diet for a Small Planet. It was like, look where this has got us. It's led to us consuming a diet of refined carbohydrates, sugars, and meat, which is bad for health and bad for the planet. And so what the book is doing is looking really at why Francis Moore Lepage had to write what she wrote and the 200 years of history leading up to that. And which is not, as you say at the beginning, it's not a purely American story. It's not a purely British story either, but I do think that Britain plays a greater role than any other country in creating these long distance systems, which are environmentally seriously problematic. And as I point out in the book, perhaps the relationship between Britain and New Zealand, which are, it's as far away from Britain as you can possibly farm. And yet this is where lamb comes from. So anyway, things that seem irrational to us today, or might seem irrational, but have also been kind of normalized. Mm-hmm. It's worth going back and looking at how that could possibly happen.
And this is where your title comes from, Diet for a Large Planet, where Great Britain saw this world that was theirs to harvest or to use or exploit for their benefit.
Yeah, completely.
Next chapter is on sugar, and we all know about the damage of sugar, but early on, it was perceived as a very efficient fuel for people to consume.
Yeah, efficient in a bodily sense and efficient in an agricultural sense. It was seen that you could get a tremendous amount of calories from a small amount of land, and these calories were worked on the body extremely quickly. And this was seen as being very good for laborers. One of the arguments here is that sugar like fills the, this is a famous argument by Sidney Mintz in a book called Sweetness and Power, that sugar fills what's called the calorie gap. It's pretty much the cheapest possible food to produce. And therefore, if you want an industrial proletariat and you need to provide them with energy, then sugar, over and above the rest of their diet, it is a way of providing them with quick, cheap energy, which enables them to work in factories or mines or whatever. And also, because it's mildly psychotropic, it has pleasant, it gives you a pleasant buzz and feels a bit luxurious at the same time.
Yes, well, it's been compared to cocaine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
It's certainly...
rightly so.
Certainly research shows that there are addictive qualities here.
Cocaine doesn't have the caloric benefit that sugar has.
No, and cocaine doesn't have the internationally sanctioned capitalist markets, which sugar in the early modern period. But obviously there's a violent history here with the history of slavery and a history of sort of, you know, sugar production, whether it's cane or beet, is grueling, hard, and pleasant work, even in a post-slavery economy.
And then the next chapter is risk. And We are seeing a great deal of risk today based on our food system. You also talk about free trade. We can put that in quotes, free trade, because there are a lot of problems inherent with free trade that aren't really free.
Right.
You say in the chapter, I will quote, these systems allow the world's most heavily industrialized regions to absorb vast quantities of food from the rest of the planet. However, these very properties, distance, processing, atmospheric manipulation, transform the parameters of food safety. And you describe this, and it again, it's difficult to read about, well, it doesn't make you want to eat anything while you're reading this, that's for sure. And it's amazing, too, I think, how humans have been so resilient with the garbage we've been feeding ourselves for so long. And we see today the result of this system is the coronavirus.
Right. I mean, obviously, the connections between livestock farming, our proximity to wildlife and so forth is one consequence of this. I mean, I write in the book about animal plagues, such as the cattle plague or rinderpest, which is a disease which we've actually eradicated in cattle, but was devastating in the 19th century. And as these kind of global markets in meat developed and in livestock, the disease begins to spread globally. It had spread in many occasions previously to this. It's not a novel development. I also talk about tuberculosis in this chapter, which was one of the primary diseases that between cattle and human beings in the 18th century abolished the issue of bovine tuberculosis among cattle in Britain now. But in the 19th century, this was a serious problem, and it was mainly a problem through milk. As I'm trying to point out in the chapter, there are emergent problems. There are also problems with food that we've overcome. So it's not a case of things getting worse. It's a case of things getting different.
Things getting different.
Yeah.
I think my favorite story or stories in the book involve potatoes.
Okay.
And again, this was another food whose stature changed over time. And you talked about the potatoes and the Irish famine and how the British perceived the Irish as a lower class, a lower caste, that they were slovenly, that the potatoes were easy to farm and these people were lazy. And to an extent, the famines that they had were even a good thing to some because it was culling an undesirable community.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's really any debate to be had over this, really. I mean, the history of Ireland, this is a colonized part of the British Isles with a subjugated native population. And when potatoes arrived in Europe, they were grown in many parts of Europe quite extensively, but in Ireland they were grown particularly extensively because of the way the Irish economy worked, which was that Irish peasants would work on the land of landowners who were English or Scottish, and the crops would be sold for markets, and they would not necessarily be paid anything, but they would have a potato patch. And a potato patch is a far more efficient way of producing calories in a small amount of space than wheat is. So you get a population that's heavily and desperately reliant upon this crop. And then the Irish were then blamed by the British for consuming this crop, which the British perceived as being inferior to wheat, and partly because it wasn't as mobilizable by capitalists. There wasn't a vast global potato trade with potato masters making huge amounts of money in the way there was with wheat. So when the famine struck, this was seen as being a way of restructuring the Irish economy, of getting rid of a surplus population and really giving that Irish land over to what it was good for, which was livestock farming. So the Irish could supply Britain with meat and with butter. And as I note in the book, what the island has a very, very peculiar demographic history. It's the only part of Europe whose population is lower now than it was in the mid-19th century. Mm-hmm. And by the early 20th century, it had the highest cattle-to-land ratio of any country in Europe. So it's definitely, this is the kind of stuff that Marx talked about. It's like the British want to get rid of people and replace them with animals. And that's what they did.
We see this kind of perspective too with the coronavirus here in the United States, where communities of color, which have a lot less privilege and are playing the role of essential workers in a lot of places, bringing us our food, are the ones who are the greatest hit and have the highest death rates. And some have said that this is a good thing. We're culling the undesirables, which is very, and I can't even begin to go there because it's just so horrific. There are a few more chapters, and in metabolism's chapter, I really loved reading about the way people consume food in their homes in the 19th century. You talked about the appearance of kitcheners and how gas cookers appeared, and the challenge with limited space and storing food. I don't really think about what they did a long time ago, but I'm like bringing it up to today. I live in New York City, and many people live in very, very small spaces, and they're probably experiencing some similar things. Some have efficiency kitchens. Some people don't even cook in their home because they don't have the space. And eating at a table without plates was seemingly luxurious compared to eating in bed. I know a lot of people who still eat in bed.
Eating in bed might seem somewhat luxurious and decadent today, but we're talking about the very poor and what a struggle it is to eat in an apartment or a house with no resources, with no cutlery, no tables, and nowhere to store food. And even if you try to store food, because of the poor atmospheric conditions of the house, that food would putrefy fairly quickly. You have to remember that refrigeration was non-existent in these homes. And in many parts of Britain, people didn't have refrigeration until the 1960s. Americans got refrigeration a little bit sooner. And this means that regular purchasing of small amounts of food is the way people lived, which is not cost effective. It's a luxury to be able to buy in bulk. And, you know, we can buy the idea of having milk in our homes that we put in a fridge. This is not possible in the 19th century. Many of the very poor barely touch milk at all as a consequence. And this is one reason why evaporated milk becomes popular. Because of its can, it's self-stored.
There's so much information in this book, and I'm just touching on little bits here and there that tickled me. For example, in the bodies chapter, you talked about the perception of how the British face changed from consuming soft food. Is this true?
Yes. Well, but a qualified yes. So it's clearly the case. The very long durée, I mean, I'm talking over the last 20, 40, 60,000 years, the human jaw has contracted. Mm. It's become less powerful. We don't chew very much, and therefore we don't necessarily need that tooth power. And this has led to dental crowding and malocclusion. Mm. Now, you can look at skeletons, and the evidence is quite clear that dental problems explode with the rise of sugar and processed foods. Now, this also feeds and is fed by a kind of cultural perception that British people had bad teeth, and it's partly because of their diet, and also that British dentists were incredibly concerned about issues like malocclusion and tooth decay. And so I have that picture in the book of this sort of drawing of a kind of pinched British face. There's something general in that about human populations. But anthropologists were making the point that this was happening dramatically more in countries which had undergone a transition towards this new diet.
Okay, so that's fascinating.
If and I think it's broadly correct. It's a form. This is not evolution in the genetic sense, but this is definitely a way in which our dietary habits are impacting on our bodies, which is what that entire chapter is about.
You have two more chapters. There's the Earth chapter where you write, Britain was, quote, a contented parasite, unquote, whose, quote, steaks and chops, unquote, contain the mineral riches of denuded landscapes from Argentina to India. We're now very well aware, some won't admit to it, but the impact of our lifestyle on the planet today. And fortunately, that's getting a lot more press. And hopefully we're going to do something about it. And then in your last chapter, you write, this book's admittedly pessimistic prognostications should not be read as an argument that the collapse of the world food system is inevitable. What is your hope for the future?
Right. I mean, one of the things that I point out in the book is that many writers have actually known or predicted the problems in the world food system from the very beginning. And that there has, throughout this history, been a strong opposition towards the evolving global food system and a strong critique of it. We can see this as I write about the history of organic farming and the history of vegetarianism in that chapter. So one hopeful dimension to this is that there has always been resistance and opposition to some of the more deleterious consequences of the way we eat. I struggle with pessimism because I don't want to be another peddler of doom. And there are too many peddlers of doom whose message is almost that we should just give up. We're by no means at a point where complete global food crisis is inevitable. But we are at a point at the moment where the strains in the system are globally evident. And we're having more and more global food crises which is a sort of interwoven effect of not just climate change, but of financialization and marketization and the renewed use of commodity frontiers in places like Africa. Sort of almost like an accelerated process of the history that I've written in the book. We also have quite understandably developing countries saying, look, we want this diet too. This is the diet of progress and prosperity.
Yep.
We want to eat more meat too, which is exactly the same as we want to drive more cars and use more oil.
Yep.
So we are reaching a real crisis point. We are resilient as a species, but what we do lack at the moment is global institutions with trust and lack of suspicion. We still have just vastly too much corporate control of foods, and we still have a very, very, very deeply embedded cultural idea of how we should eat. In the same way as we have a very, very deeply culturally embedded idea about how much water we should use and how much we should be able to drive. These things are very, very hard to unthink. Very, very difficult.
Yes, indeed. My last question for you is, how has all of this information informed your own personal life and your choices?
Well, I think I'm a much more conscious eater than I used to be. I've always been a fairly conscious eater. I've always been interested in foods. Unlike you, I'm not a vegetarian. I'm someone who eats a small amount of meat. Certainly the sourcing of meat is important. I like to get my meat, if possible, from a sort of local butcher, which is particularly chicken, which is the most egregiously farmed animal in the United States, where I have some idea that the animal has lived a better life than those animals I describe in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I try to use farmers markets. I also have two kids and a busy life, and like other people, I have to make compromises. I live as ethically pure a life as possible, but I ethically fairly compromised life in many respects. I think one of the things I do here at OSU is I teach food history, and one of the best things I can do is to sort of teach some of them and to make them more aware of the history of food, but also the complexity of the food they eat and the way that their choices can make a difference. So that's how it's changed my life. I hope my children know more about food than most children do, perhaps as a consequence of living with me. Now, I've learned a lot, and it's sometimes been a depressing story. But I'm not a complete pessimist. We have the capacity to change. I'm just not sure what the mechanisms are for doing that.
I'm glad to hear you're optimistic. I think compromise is a key word here. There's a lot of balance, learning about all that's gone wrong and how we stay enthusiastic about our future. And that's our work.
Yes. Yeah.
That's our work. Well, Chris Otter, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. This book, Diet for a Large Planet, is amazing. It's heavy. I don't know how you put so much information into each sentence. You could grab a whole nother book and by making it an adjective in your sentence.
Right. Yeah.
To bring in a whole nother idea. It's just brilliant. Bravo.
Well, thank you very much for your interview and for your kind words, Karen. I hope you have a pleasant day and I hope you have a nice dinner tonight too.
Oh, thank you. I'm getting hungry already.
Well, I'm glad I haven't put you completely off food.
No. Okay. Take care. Be well.
Bye-bye.
So we have hope for the future. That's good to know. And now, to lighten things up a little bit, with some lovely food conversation, Gary DiMattei. Whoa, a little musical interlude there.
Ooh. Those were the angels, the holiday angels.
Angels we have heard on high?
Yes, angels we have heard get high. Wait. What? You can't say that. This is a family show.
It is? This is a progressive show.
Oh, that's right. So we could say it.
We can
angels
say
we have heard
get high.
Get high.
Woo! Silly Gary. This is a big week.
Big week for consumers.
Big week for consumers. We just went through a big snowstorm last week. We all hunkered down, stayed cozy.
Well, we did, but not the rest of the world. They went through their own weather challenges.
Sure, in some places it's summertime.
Summertime.
Yeah.
Yes. I am certain that we will get more snow, but right now, today was quite lovely. Wasn't cold. We have the windows open.
Yes.
And so that's nice. This is the second day after the winter solstice, and we're doing pretty well.
Yeah, it actually was a high of 43 degrees today.
Yeah.
In New York. That's pretty balmy.
Pretty balmy. But it was getting down to freezing, a little below freezing.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't tune in for the weather report, but we're just going to give it to you anyway.
Well, I think that weather affects food in many ways.
Right.
It certainly affects what's growing in your area, but it also affects what you want to eat. When it's really warm out, I crave fruit, berries, tropical fruit. And then as it gets colder, it's tea and soup for me all the way.
Yeah, you made a lovely mango pudding last night, and it was made with bananas and frozen mango.
Yeah, so I use tropical fruits, and it is now officially winter, but...
But you bought it frozen.
But I bought it frozen. I didn't use fresh fruit, so let me qualify. When in summer, I consume a lot of fresh fruit.
Right.
And then in the colder weather, we take advantage of frozen food. And I'm smiling as I say that, because after just speaking with Chris Otter and talking about Diet for a Large Planet, we have to acknowledge how much food we get that doesn't come from an area where we live.
Nice segue to do the recap on the book, because that interview is kind of disturbing for me, because I wasn't aware of any of the things that you and Chris discussed.
Well, I would like to think that if the motive behind our global exports was pure, then it would be justified. But as he explained, the United Kingdom, England, originally in mid-19th century, industrial era, when the Industrial Revolution began, it was all about feeding the British people
at the expense of the rest of the world. Now, they may not have thought about it that way, but in some ways it sounded like they thought they deserved it.
Yeah, it did, didn't it?
And it was okay to colonize. It was okay to exploit because they could get certain kinds of food for much less, even though they were transporting it from the other end of the world and paying people ridiculous wages, very low. Somehow they justified it all and became very dependent on the rest of the world for their food.
Right.
Which, fast forward to 2020, I don't know how secure they're feeling. But putting that aside, if we could have a world system, a global food system, where we all take advantage of the different climates that people have so we can all share in the bounty during the harvest season, wherever it may be, and we can share in the diversity, and if everybody can be paid an equitable wage, and if there's a way to minimize the carbon that we put into the atmosphere by transporting some of these foods, that's the future that I'm looking for.
I mean,
to.
I'm not saying it was intentional, but whoever was in charge during this time, it sure sounds like they threw the British people under the proverbial double-decker bus with their choices that to bring in all of their food.
And not really healthy food.
Right.
Right. A lot of meat, a lot of sugary foods, a lot of processed foods. Okay, we compromise. So we do get organic frozen fruits that are not from New York, and we take advantage of them all year round. And is that the most sensible, sustainable thing to do? I can't answer that question. I'm just very grateful that we have access to that food, and I wish it for everyone.
Sure. It's in the store. It's in the frozen food section. It's frozen fruit, frozen mango. I think it's okay. I think you're not going to get kicked out of the club.
Good. Let's talk about the holiday coming up. And what holiday is that, Gary?
Well, we just left Hanukkah.
Yep.
And we're heading into the holiday known as Christmas.
Yes, the holiday known as Christmas.
Yes. Now, that was a holiday that you did not celebrate growing up because you were raised Jewish. And however, I celebrated Christmas. I didn't celebrate Hanukkah. We've been doing a lot of Hanukkah celebrating and have had a wonderful time doing it. We light the menorah every year. And it's not because we're religious.
No.
It's because we like
lighting candles.
Lighting candles and singing.
Lighting candles and singing and making potato pancakes.
Right. So we enjoy the festive nature of holidays. So
and
we,
food.
Right. So for us, the holidays are pretty secular. It's just an opportunity to celebrate the season.
Yeah. So what are we going to make this year?
Well, we have this lovely Feast of the Seven Dishes up at the Responsible Eating and Living website. And I think it's just a great guide for what to make around the holidays.
Now, let's start from the beginning. The Feast of the Seven Dishes, D, like David, dishes,
right,
is a play on a phrase.
The Feast of the Seven Fishes. I was raised Catholic. I am of Italian ancestry. So the big deal was, on Christmas Eve, you would have this thing known as the Feast of the Seven Fishes, where you would make seven huge platters of all kinds of different seafood, frutta di mare. After I went vegan, I thought, well, that was really fun, but not for the fish. But what was fun about it was you could get all of these great dishes. And some cultures call it Feast of the 10 Dishes, Feast of the 15 Dishes, whatever. As I said, I'm not a religious person, but I am spiritual, and I do like the idea of folks getting together, celebrating, and now that we have to be socially distant, celebrating on Zoom. So it's fun to cook a lot of food on Christmas Eve, and then some of those dishes now I've called Feast of the Seven Dishes. And check it out. It's really a lot of fun. We have antipasti, which is the appetizer. We have primo, which is the first course. We have lots of suggestions for that. One of my favorites is the lasagna al forno.
Mm.
But there's also a risotto veganese.
You haven't made that in a while. Yeah. I vote for that.
And then we also do the polenta that you created, which is based on a recipe from one of my aunts.
A polenta torta. Polenta. It looks like a layer cake, but it's savory.
And it's pretty easy to make. You make the polenta, you pour it in a round dish, like a souffle dish. And then once it chills or hardens, you slice it like a three-layer cake. And then you layer it with mushrooms and a nice creamy cheesy sauce that you make. It's a beautiful recipe.
Gary, I have to note that you just said the word mushrooms and you didn't gag.
No, I can't gag.
You're really evolving.
Evolving, yes.
This is Gary, you know, who doesn't like mushrooms.
But it looks so delicious, and I would recommend that if you want something wonderful and something different to try, try the polenta torta. It's Karen's recipe and it's fantastic. Then the second course, usually, traditionally, is another meat or fish dish. And so we have the osso vita, which has been featured in a few cookbooks. Or at least one cookbook, right?
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's right. Gorgeous, Gary.
And it's based on osso buco, but this is made with seitan, which is wheat gluten. So not for those who are gluten-free. And it's made like an osso buco. And it's
what
delicious.
Is osso buco for those who don't know what that is?
It's the shank of the poor baby cow. Veal shank.
Yeah.
And this is a way to have that, but not do any harm to any of the animals. And it even has a soft center. Then we have a tofu calamari steak, which is lovely. We have a filet of sole, spelled S-O-U-L, which is a marinated tempeh steak. Those are some of the second course items, which is a very nice
They're
trio.
All beautiful and substantial. Now, in the days of feasting of the seven fishes, for example, would all of these dishes be served? Or
no,
is this like a choice?
Only seven courses. So these are your choices.
Right.
And of course, you'll have your own choices. And then there's the side dishes, the contorni. There's the sautéed greens that we have there. There's the garlic mashed potatoes. There's the verdura mista al forno, which is oven-baked vegetables. And then there's the salad. We have a few. We have a Caesar. We have a roasted red root vegetable salad. Very, very colorful, very festive for this time of year. You like escarole. And so we have an escarole salad.
We have to find escarole. It's not easy to find all the time, especially when you're having your food delivered and you're not going to a store.
No, it's not. But we do a nice grilled escarole.
With lemon and big
capers,
white beans.
And it's really lovely.
Yeah.
Now we're getting to the good part. The sixth dish is the, you know, after that huge meal, they break out the cheese and the fruit and the nuts and all of that. So we have the formaggi e frutta as the sixth course. And we have your recipe for almond mozzarella, which is the most popular recipe on our website.
That's correct.
And then we have our cashew jack, and we have our vegan buffalo mozzarella. But now the best part, the seventh course, or the seventh dish, which is the dolce, the
yes.
sweets. And this year, I think we're just going to skip all six of the courses.
Just go right to
and
dessert.
Go right to the dessert. I vote for the cannoli.
Absolutely. I second that vote. We
Your
haven't made
cannoli
them in a long
recipe
time.
Is the best cannoli recipe I've ever eaten.
Well, what I love about the shell
right,
is it's, number one, it's gluten-free, and number two, it's not fried, folks.
No.
It's really easy to make. The dough rolls like butter.
It
well,
does.
Does butter roll? Anyway, it rolls easily. You do need to have those round tubes to wrap the dough around.
Sure, or you could take a redwood closet rod like the old timers used to do
no.
and cut it up and wrap it around. I kid you not.
Wow.
Yeah, wrap it around a piece of a redwood closet pole.
So if you have a tube that's maybe what, half inch wide or a little wider, an inch wide,
yeah.
you could wrap your cannoli dough around there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as it's heat proof.
Yeah.
Has to be oven proof. And then the other wonderful thing that you took a recipe and veganized it was the crostata di ricotta, which is on our website. And that to me needs to be made again. That is fabulous. That's from an ancient recipe that you took from one of my favorite cookbooks growing up. and you adapted it for a, well, you made it dairy-free, you made it vegan, and it's basically a baked cheesecake, and it's wonderful. And it's made with nuts.
Yep, made with nuts.
What kind of nuts do you use? Did you use almonds, or
yes,
did you use...
Yes, this is an almond ricotta.
Quite a few, right?
Yeah, a lot of almonds.
You make a little baby one now, too, sometimes, because you don't want to use so many.
Yes.
And then we have a torta al limone, which we've just been getting some requests for vegan recipes using lemon, because a lot of friends in California have a huge lemon harvest now. And I say, make this. This is one of my favorites. Everybody wants to make a lemon bar, but I would go right to this torta al limone, another one of your creations.
Which yeah, I gotta make that again.
Which I feel is one of your finer recipes.
So many desserts to make.
But now we're doing desserts without sugar, so we have to try these again with date paste.
The next dessert on the Feast of the Seven Dishes is the almond biscotti, and I have not modified or updated it, but I have made it with dates only and not sugar. And if you're interested in that version of the almond biscotti, you can reach out to me at info@realmeals.org, because I haven't updated it and I'm not sure when I'm going to, if I'm going to, on responsibleeatingandliving.com. But there's one recipe that isn't in the Feast of the Seven Dishes that I want to mention.
Yeah, we have to mention it.
Because it's something that simple and yet so elegant and lovely. It's called the Angela Pia.
It's such a beautiful dish.
And it means pious angel. So for those of you who are into Christmas and the Christmas spirit and the angels up on high, this is a dessert that goes very well with it all. It's very simple. It's made with silken tofu, has some sugar in it, and some bourbon and vermouth. It has a little alcohol in it. You don't
it's
get
very
drunk
festive.
On this.
It's very
just
festive.
It's
all cooked
flavor.
Out by the time you get
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Some of these recipes that we're talking about have soy lecithin granules. Why? Because they give the desserts a richness and an egg-like flavor. The good part of the egg, not the bad part of the egg. Eggs often have a sulfury flavor that I particularly don't care for. But that rich lecithin flavor, because eggs have lecithin in it, and I'm really being careful saying lecithin.
You're doing very well.
Thank you. And there's different kinds of lecithin, and I really prefer the soy lecithin granules. Choose non-GMO and organic, of course, if possible, because of the consistency and the flavor. We also use a sunflower liquid lecithin when we make vegan butter, because that was in Miyoko's recipe, so we have that. It's not the same. The flavor isn't the same, the color isn't the same, the consistency isn't the same. And I prefer the soy lecithin.
Now, this Angela Pia is delicious. And again, it was a dish from my childhood that I gave you a recipe for and you veganized it. And it is a wonderful, wonderful dish. You did a beautiful job with this.
Thank you, Gary.
And it's like a very light dessert from the angels, basically.
Yeah, it's a rich vanilla pudding.
Right. It's beautiful. You pour it in little dishes and chill it. You can even eat it warm. And it's really, really a great end to a meal. And very festive. A very festive dish.
And the other one, which I'd like to make this year, is a cookie recipe that I veganized last year.
Yeah,
from
they're fabulous.
An ancient family Di Mattei recipe.
Yeah, they were
the
fabulous.
The cucciadari.
Cucciadari! And you've got some figs in there. I think you might have to make...
I'm going to make some cucciadari.
We have some dried figs.
Yeah.
This is a cookie that's made with dried figs and all kinds of wonderful... It's like a fig Newton, but it's like a fig Newton that...
A festive fig Newton.
A festive fig Newton. It's a traditional Italian cookie that's made around the holidays, and it's wonderful. So check out Responsible Eating and Living's Feast of the Seven Dishes, which is a riff on Feast of the Seven Fishes, because as you know, we don't eat fish, but we like to party.
Now, we're not encouraging big gatherings. We're not encouraging any kind of gathering this year because of coronavirus. But if you're alone or you're with a small group, you can still make it festive by making one of these dishes or several of these dishes. If you're making cookies, for example, you can make a lot and then ship some to those you're missing.
Now, there's one recipe we talked about that I want to recap again, because it is deceptive when you look at it. It looks like a big hunk of meat, and that's the Osso Vita. We even have a comment on our site about the Feast of the Seven Dishes, and the person commenting said, thank you for the wonderful vegan suggestions, except for the meat recipe. They were all suitable for a seasoned vegan such as myself. It looks like meat, but it's not. It's seitan. And Karen answered the question, of course, with, it's 100% vegan. There's no meat. You might be referring to the Osso Vita, which can be also found in the Living the Farm Sanctuary Life cookbook. Our recipe is in there. So if you're looking for a last-minute gift, send the Farm Sanctuary cookbook to somebody. You'll be supporting Farm Sanctuary, which is not a bad organization to support.
It's one of the best.
Yes, it is. It's one of the best. Yes. Thank you very much.
Well, Gary, we're coming to the end of the year soon, and we're coming to the end of this hour.
Wow, that flew by. The year did not fly by, but this hour flew by. Will this year ever end?
It will, in about a week.
In about a week. Very, very, very looking forward to that.
Yes.
And so, Karen, just I want to wish you a very happy holiday and thank you for what you do, what you bring to this program every week. You bring enlightenment, you bring information, you bring education, and I think you deserve a round of applause.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Gary. I think everybody deserves a round of applause for getting through 2020.
Let's hope you're all safe.
Oh.
Just wanted to do a little
angel
gliss
cheer.
Because we were talking about the angels.
Yes.
And the Angela Pia is from the angels.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The pious angels.
The pious angels. Okay, everybody, thanks for joining us today. I'm Karen Hartglass here with Gary DeMattei. You've been listening to It's All About Food.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays.
Have a delicious week. Ho, 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 ho.